The title today is What Could Be Better? And it comes from one of my teachers named Punjaji, who used to talk a lot about letting go of practice and just resting in knowing that you're already free. Yet he did spend like decades doing intensive practice, and while he was saying don't practice, every day he would sit cross-legged with his eyes closed several times for hours. So for him, what he said was when he said don't practice, it was not to put ourselves in a place of lack, and from the place of lack of not having, trying to get through our actions. But once we have found what our real practice is, what he said about that was, what would you rather do? What could be better than doing that thing that we could call practice, or we could call our passion for life, we could call just what could be better? And I have in mind, partly in this talk, a question from someone about not taking things so personally, that apparently I said something about that in one of the instructions, but since I don't remember, it will be part of a thread of this talk as well. And mostly I'll just be, as usual, repeating myself. So also feel free to ask any questions that you didn't ask in the other talks. There's a very famous meditation teacher who's alive now, who was asked one time how his experience of what is in Buddhism called non-self, how that has affected his life, how he lives that. And so this kind of idea and word like non-self is so easily used against ourselves, as if we should somehow not exist, or somehow we should have the courage to destroy ourselves. And what Joseph said about his experience of not self was that his friends tell him he takes himself more lightly, that he has more sense of humor about himself. That's what he said. A nice, simple, experiential answer. If we would hear just the word not self and think that we are supposed to attain that not self as something that I don't have, that I have to try to create or twist myself into, and if we would do that, we would definitely miss the chance to welcome our real practice, that thing that, what else would you rather do? What could be better? It's a unique, creative expression of life that happens through us. And if we hear that what not self is trying to say, what those two words are trying to say, is that our sense of separation from life, from ourselves, from each other, is not the real truth. And what our practice is what helps us feel the truth through, even if there is a sense of separation, that we don't believe it, that we can see through it, feel through it. Something that's more true than even the most intense sense of isolation. And so we have a kind of delightful place that we could sit in each day, trying to feel for ourselves, what is the inner gesture that I could go through the day doing that would help me see through the sense of separation and feel through, experience something more true than isolation? What is that thing I could go on doing all day long, no matter what else I'm doing? What is it that allows the nourishment in this deep, subtle place? And what could be better? And we can take it everywhere. In Tibetan Buddhism, that practice that we do all day long would be called post-meditation. Not because it's like higher than meditation, but it's when you finish your formal practice and you get up, what do you start doing? What could be better? Not because we're obliged to, not because someone else told us to, but something that it might be sparked by things we've heard and seen, but it comes from us. It's in our own inner way and inner language that it comes. And even if sometimes it's hard to do that thing, we love also to do that thing. Staying back, staying down, remembering a word or whatever. And we also get to feel into what is it that is our formal practice, so-called. Formal doesn't mean formal, sit up straight and put on your suit or your uniform or whatever. But formal in the sense of you take time away from other outer activities and you set that time aside. It might be to lie down in the fetus position under your favorite blanket in the sunshine. So not formal like as an outer formality, not formalities. When that time that we can let go of all the formalities and meet ourselves. Where something lightly takes us, and then during the day we notice we take ourselves more lightly. So we make an appointment where we have time. It would be like in a love affair, we want to be with that person, not only enjoy thinking about them, but we also want to be with them. So that's that hour or whatever. That kind of, what else would you want to do? And then also during the whole day when we're doing other things, we're still with the lover inside. It would be so much easier if we could just follow a formula. In a way, or at least for the mind, it sounds easier. The mind wouldn't have to be so scared and courageous. But I love the image of the orchestra, of all the different instruments. So it's not that we have to all play the oboe or the violin and play the same song. But with each of those different kinds of sounds that we have, each of us is, the music has many more possibilities and much more roundness and spaciousness. And I love to feel that when we're actually singing together. How we start off, each in the way that we start off. Some people with confidence, some people without confidence. And then as we start to relax, how the voices change. And how we could really feel each person's just bare gift of their voice. What could be better? And it's not like if there were someone else in the room that would disturb this music, then that would also be better. What could be better? Or if someday we feel like, we really, really feel like being in the singing, but singing quietly or being silent. So it's not about the outer. It's about just that quality that goes with us everywhere and keeps touching us and others because it is alive. And the voice, I find, is a great example, as well as being a real thing that is so uniquely an expression of an individual. If we hear someone's voice, we can recognize that it's that person. It's not anyone else. And at the same time, if we listen to our own voice, sometimes when we free the voice, we let it sing. We can hardly recognize it. And at the same time, it's so familiar. And at the same time, what is that? Whose voice is that? Like, it's not that we created the voice by kind of following a recipe. We just kind of got landed with that voice. As in the outer, so in the inner, sometimes it can be easier in a situation like singing to appreciate the quality that each person is bringing to the singing, and how that's so much themselves, and also so much something that they did not make, that they don't really exactly completely control. It's their voice and not their voice. And really accepting those differences and the beauty that can be there. That sometimes can help when we come to the inner voices as well. To try to actually feel and even appreciate the quality of each of the inner voices, even the ones we don't like. And I don't know if you've noticed how sometimes this kind of sincere appreciation, not trying to appreciate or out of a feeling of lack appreciating something, but out of a feeling of richness of each voice appreciating another voice. That kind of appreciation sometimes can draw the juices out even more. So when there's an inner voice that we don't like, and we find an appreciation for that voice, even if it's uncomfortable, it could draw some juice out of that voice. We could find that by not getting into a fight with that voice, by taking it more lightly, or by even reaching into the richness and juiciness, that what is actually delicious about that voice. That kind of person or character or energy inside can fall into place in a more creative, more harmonious way. And I want to tell a story about some school children that could help us accept this and try this appreciation, drawing out the richness. It's a story that I really love, so if you've heard it before, I hope you love to hear it again, as I do. There were some school kids, and it sounds like they were maybe around 12 years old. I'm not sure. And one of the students was the very bad student, who was aggressive and mean and nasty to everyone, of the other students and the teachers. So remember that you know that voice inside, that student inside. And you know that sometimes you end up being that bad student. in certain situations. We all have the situation that's the kind of situation that's hard, and we end up being the bad student there in that class. And the easiest thing to do if you're already the bad student is to keep being the bad student. That's what everyone is expecting anyway. And eventually, it always will come eventually to a head, to a kind of crisis point, inside or outside. There'll be a crisis point where someone in charge decides something must be done about this. But then, if we could pause and feel what to do and not just go to the usual tools of aggression. So in the case of the bad student in this class, there was a decision to have a meeting. And one idea that came was to confront the student with how much what you did to me hurt me, and have each person come up and say, you did that to me and it hurt me. And that's relatively enlightened kind of approach, like to kind of bring some vulnerability and let the child be aware of the consequences, etc. But luckily the teacher in charge was even more creative than that. So instead of just talking about badness and how it hurts, we already all know that actually, don't we? If we could see through that separation, instead of creating more separation by relating to the bad student as the bad student and how you hurt me, if we find another way of relating to that student, seeing something else. And so they called the bad student in for the meeting, and each person spoke to the bad student. One by one they spoke. But they all said the same thing. Each person looked at the bad student, hopefully not feeling just bad student, and said, you belong. And then the next person came and said, you belong. Then the next person came and said, you belong. So there's not that kind of arrogance of assuming that what I don't like doesn't belong. And there is the confidence to see through what I don't like to something more true. To take my own hurt, my own having been kicked out, feeling not belonging. To see through that to how we belong. So it's not like that my voice belongs to me, but my voice does belong here to life. And then these voices belong. And the student got it. As our unique mix inside of ourselves, we share the fact of each being unique. We share that situation of being able to relate to others and understand what they're talking about and also not. We each have different kinds and shapes of knots, like K-N-O-T, when something is tangled together. And so we can't predict which way any of us will find to be that way that's the what could be better way of untying the knot. And being lightly taken by life. And so even though the Buddha made this amazing statement when he was already realized, I think it's a statement that we could put into practice, not being yet realized. He said that the wise person does not rate himself or herself with those who are the superior or the better. Rate means like place or put value on, make myself higher, like put a number on, let's say. I don't put a high number on myself with those high people. I don't put a low number on myself with the low people. I also don't put a medium number on myself. We could say, ah, the Buddha, isn't it about the middle way? And then we go for anything in between. A high and a low must be the middle way. But we also don't rate ourselves with those who are in the middle. We just don't rate ourselves. And that means we could also free other people from the rating system. 1 star, 5 star, 3 stars. If we really let ourselves rest, and if we take our busyness and our speed more lightly, we do see that there's not someone who's ahead and someone who's behind, and someone who's equal in a race. Each person's difficulties and gifts, and each person's putting into practice of their best guess and their wisdom, has a different flavor, has a different voice. But we can tune into that quality of, what could be better with ourselves and with each other in feeling that uniqueness. And that the resolution of what's naughty in us will be something unpredictable. It will not be doing that same old thing that we read about. It will be something fresh. I love, these days I'm reading a lot about the ideas and the life of Matisse, who's a famous painter from France. In his time, he was really breaking through all of the traditions in his contemporary culture. Now people try to paint the way he did, just first thing, rather than going through all the training that he did to paint and draw that way. We kind of copy him now. No longer is easy to see what a breakthrough his work was and potentially is now for us. And he talked about painting a flower. So a painting of a flower, that's not a particularly original idea. But in order to paint the flower the way he felt called to paint it, he said it could never happen in the way one expects. And so the humility and the openness to let the freshness come through with the tools at hand. So he didn't need to invent a new medium We don't need to have something other than the body and the mind and the heart and the being. He used the paint and the brush and the canvas in a fresh way. And that is a transmission of his unique calling, his unique voice, we could say. He also talked about, it's very interesting, his relationship to the tradition that he was breaking and then needing to widen the sense of what is my tradition, so the tradition of art. And he said it's so much easier for him to dive into his unique way, which happened to be explosive at his time. People would go to see his painting so that they could laugh at them. At the time in France and Paris, if his paintings would be displayed, people would actually go to have a laugh, but they would laugh like almost falling on the floor, laughing. It was such a breakthrough at the time. So imagine the courage to keep going with that calling. And he couldn't stay away from. He would go, his wife would try to keep him at home. But he would go to the gallery and just stand on the side and watch the people laughing. He said it was so much easier to give himself fully to his unique path when he did find some echoes in tradition. And what he meant by that was not like the French painters before him, but the Islamic art and Asian art, Japanese art, the Russian icons that he came across after he had already started on his way. So it wasn't a copying, it was a doing, and then as his way became more clear to him, that it was a lot about color and spontaneity with a very rigorous training, not just laziness, then he could recognize more clearly the traditions, his predecessors, his, we could say, spiritual ancestors, and feel their encouragement to keep going in what he then saw, his own breakthroughs, as inevitable breakthroughs for that time.
What is inevitable?
Like, it couldn't almost have happened any other way, even though it was so radically different. So what he's expressing is the kind of impersonality, the impersonalness of what he was doing, even though it was took a lot of personal courage and discipline and constancy, like steadiness, and honesty, like really staying with, not going off track with what was calling him. So when we think about not self, not being a separate self, it can be interesting, it can also be worthwhile, helpful to feel in what way does tradition and culture and sangha, which is like we could say spiritual community, in what way does it help? In what way could it get in the way? If he hadn't had some art, if Matisse had not had some artist friends who were also feeling a calling to break through something and feeling their way in the dark for decades before being able to look back and see some encouragement from the spiritual ancestors, he may not have been able to keep going. If he'd only been with artists, if we would only be with spiritual people who have a different calling or a different way or a fixed way, it would be easy not to hear our unique voice calling us. So if we have at least some friends who have at least a calling, even if a different one, that keeps tugging at them, pulling them from the fixed ideas, pulling them from like a kind of easy, closed community. And also when we look at the traditions that maybe are currently helping us, we could always be ready to look a little beyond what is, let's say, the common response to. So something other than what the people who go to the gallery are thinking and why they're laughing. So in the last couple of decades, a lot of Asian and Indian spiritual traditions have been brought over to the West. And I'm so glad for this. I remember being in high school, being 17 or 18, and I went to a Christian high school, but we did have a world religion class. But the teacher didn't know about world religion. And so we each took a religion and did a report on it. And at that time, it was just to go to the library and get the big book with the thin pages and the tiny print and summarize the story of the Buddha. I did Buddhism. So it's kind of very crude and very little, not much resource, not many resources to go into or go with. But then it would be easy to go really so quickly with, there's so much on offer, even if we look into what's Buddhist on offer in the West. Or pick any religion, but let's say Buddhist. There's so much on offer, and sometimes so often all based on each other rather than coming from each from a different part of Buddhism in the East. Or it so easily starts to be, this is the way that we transplant Buddhism to the West. And then it's easy to ignore what is being left in the East and what might be a value and what's being left out. So as we bring from the East to the West, Buddhism, for example, what we often, not always, but often leave in the East is the role of women in the Buddhist communities in the East, which is often serving and devotion. That's often what the nuns are told to do, for example. And so we, of course, don't want to come here and say, okay, girls, you're on this side, boys, you're on this side. Girls, would you please go make dinner while we talk about spiritual things? But, I mean, actually, maybe that would be a great thing to do now, if we could do it lightly. And we would know that the cooking and serving of dinner was the real thing. The talking about the spiritual would be the superficial thing. But what is it in that serving and devotional practices that rounded out the part that the men were more often playing in the Eastern communities? And we've only taken the masculine part to the West because we obviously don't want to put women back in the kitchen kind of thing. But what is that quiet, unpretentious, practical, humble, and heartful part of, let's say, the Buddhist path that has often not been or has been awkwardly transplanted to the West? And how could we feel that that is missing? It's so easy that if we go with Buddhist offerings, that it goes dry after a few years. How could we round it out, or it goes mental, or it goes arrogant, as I know, through the ideas, or I do the meditation? or it goes impractical, etc. So how could we bring in that practical and sweet, humble? Where we're going about a spiritual life without wearing the uniform, without being encouraged to be proud about it. As we transplant some of the Eastern practices, maybe already to kind of round out what was available in the West, which were often Christian or Jewish practices that were missing that kind of silence, continuity of stillness, and diving into a realm without language or symbol. How could we keep rounding things out? Bringing back the sweetness that makes practice be that thing that, what could be better? So one thing that I've noticed for us in the West, I'll give maybe a little bit more extreme example that you could then soften in your own case if it's softer. I have a number of friends who have something called chronic fatigue syndrome. If you haven't heard of it, they're debilitated by fatigue. And they...
What's fatigue?
Fatigue. Exhaustion.
All right, yeah.
And there's usually no known kind of medical cause or cure. There is... apparently, from what I know from my friends, I have not studied this like in any kind of formal way, is that there is sometimes or often a kind of trauma or stress that triggers the pattern to be active, that like makes that mushroom flower, makes it propagate, makes it take over. And so sometimes when they find that there's no medicine and there's no help in the known avenues, people will come to meditation to try to have some healing and release. But often the practices that we normally do on a retreat, like being still, watching the mind, and even just relaxing, could be like relaxing, and then at a certain point of relaxation, something triggers the syndrome. So it's fatigue and a sense of isolation. Watching the mind, and then what it just starts to lean into the pattern of too much observing and controlling, already being too good at observing and controlling. And so the usual tools that someone would have who can't use medication to help don't work. They make the thing worse, they make the symptom worse. If our situation is not so extreme, we still might notice how what we could now call traditional tools, like watching the mind or even relaxation, sometimes bring us to a kind of trigger point. So we relax and something's opening. Sometimes we feel what we could call the true heart, which is so deep and feels so real and is so unguarded that sometimes the only other experience that's similar to that, that we're aware of having, is hurt. When we feel hurt, we feel how deeply it goes. We can feel, it's not quite as deep as the true heart, but it's quite deep sometimes, the hurt. And that hurt is unguarded. There's something true about it. There's something real about it. So sometimes when we have an experience of what I call today the true heart, it's so similar to the feeling of true hurt, of a real hurt, that something in us kind of jumps and translates it as hurt. And sometimes we have a kind of trust and stillness that we could jump back into the actual experience of true heart. Yes, vulnerable, deep, unguarded. It's almost as if it hurts. So sometimes we can jump back to that experience where it's almost as if it hurts. It's so raw and bare and deep. And sometimes we can adjust our ways of paying attention and relaxing, and sometimes it's just a matter of experience that we start to then trust the true heart and be able to reach through the hurt to the true heart. But sometimes it's not just a matter of adjusting the technique that's been handed down in the schools of Western Buddhism. It might be that we need to bring in, round out the tradition, break through the tradition in a way that later will be clearly inevitable, was clearly needed at this time. To bring in the heartful, the humble, the practical. Not by only going to the kitchen, sweeping the bathroom or whatever. Not only that, also that, but in some way that will keep calling you, that will be original for you. That's not got sexism built into it. If we can care for each other's finding our way, fumbling into our way, that it's sensitive in the depths. And also if we can take care of our own heart, that just because we are with so-called sangha, like-minded people, completely needed, but just because we are with people that are called sangha or like-minded or like-hearted or whatever, doesn't mean like just being in the minority doesn't mean that we're all always looking out for the best interest of each other. And if we could just be aware of that, that we could take care of the true heart in all of us. And we could take care of the true heart in us and not assume others will. So that when others don't, maybe they really are stuck with that idea that you must sit for meditation, for example, and they want to pound it into you for your own good. Or that you must lie down, whatever. If we can also, it's not just to take care and go away back into isolation, but to take care so that we can also take each other more lightly. If I can accept that you might have some cultural prejudices coming in that are not in my best interest, or not in her best interest or his best interest or whatever. If I can see through that, to your true heart. It will be easier to take what we could say what's not true, what makes separation. You could take it lightly, not take it personally. It can help when we feel that as much as we have our uniqueness, we are also have the same kind of canvas, brush, and paints to be creative with. And so the Buddha can talk about the experience of ill will or negativity, for example, and we understand what he's talking about. Some of us may have a lot of negativity to deal with at some point, or much of the time. And others of us may have more sense of lack, wanting, greed. Our kind of package of knots is different, but at the same time it's kind of made from the same materials, and we could feel the sharedness of that. So I want to actually give 5 images that the Buddha gives to talk about not just what it's like to experience ill will and how we can all relate to that, but we can also relate to the gladness when we've let that go. So our unique package of what are called the 5 hindrances, the 5 things that make us feel separate. So the first is, it's usually called like wanting or greed or covetousness. We could also say a feeling of lack. And the Buddha's image for that is when we are in debt. If I imagine that I'm in debt and I can't pay it off, that's the experience of wanting. It's actually a feeling of not having. Of having what's not really mine, or wanting. And the freedom from wanting, the freedom from that not having, that lack, he gives. I think it's so sweet, the Buddha who lived a life of renunciation, still freely talking about what it would be like. So this is again, it wasn't the Buddha's path to be a business person, but he can know what it feels like. So he said, you might have been in debt, and then you started a business. And it was so successful that not only could you pay off the debt, you had something extra to have a family, to support a family. So I love the image and to feel not only to pay off the debt, not only to just no longer be relating from a place of lack, of not having enough, but having so much enough, so much more than enough, that we can actually support others, we can support our family. So these simple images that we can relate to. The second hindrance of ill will, negativity. The Buddha says it's like being sick, so that basically the food can't really nourish the body, and the body has no strength. It takes all the strength of the body. I find this is a really helpful image about negativity, about ill will, because sometimes it's confusing. We think we confuse the power of the emotion or mind state, because the negativity feels, because it's aggressive, we recognize that as power. That's our usual meaning for the word power, is aggression. So the aggression, the ill will, the negativity is taking all of our energy. We have no strength left. And no nourishment can come in. So it's actually a state of weakness, negativity, though it's confusing because it seems, because it's aggression, it seems powerful, but it's actually an experience of weakness. And of course the freedom from ill will is when we're well again and we can actually eat food and digest it And if you've ever been sick in that way, you know what? Talk about what could be better. Just eating plain rice or whatever. And then the third hindrance is called sloth and torpor. And I love to bring this one up on a deep rest retreat because it's also confusing. We could think that by lying around we're being lazy. But if we really see what's happening, we know that laziness is something else. It's not just what's happening on the outer actions. Laziness could be just sitting and sitting and sitting and sitting and sitting because someone told us to, and we can't bother to actually feel what's appropriate. And so the image for sloth and torpor is being in prison. We can't move freely. We can't actually do what's appropriate. We can only do that one thing. Which these days, sloth and torpor manifests itself most commonly in our culture as busyness. We can't do other than that. But the fourth hindrance is restlessness. And I think this is also a very accurate image. So being a slave, so it's not just being in prison, but you're under someone else's control and they decide what you do. So maybe that's, to me, like there's the laziness of going along with it, and then there's the restlessness where you can't decide to be still, you can't decide to be kind, you can't decide because something else is making you work all day. Unable to go where one wants is the way the Buddha puts it. And the freedom from sloth and torpor, the freedom from restlessness, of course, is being let out of prison. And finding that nothing, no one has taken over your house while you were gone, or no one's stolen anything while you were gone. You're back in your life. Or you're freed from slavery, and again, no one has stolen anything from you. You can go where you want. And then, I also love the last image, that's why I'm including these in the talk, I find them so clear. And also to include something from a tradition. Something that I never heard in many years of studying Buddhism. So the fifth hindrance is doubt. And the image of doubt, the experience of doubt, is like being a wealthy person with property and having to cross a desert with all of your precious belongings. So we have to think of what it was like at the time, maybe probably in many deserts. Maybe like it would be like going through Afghanistan unguarded with all of your, let's say, a lot of batteries or whatever, something that an army might want to take from you. One time being in a bus in Sri Lanka going to a rainforest. And the bus was stopped. This is also many years ago when the Civil War was happening. And just kind of one village, the bus stopped, and we had to, just any batteries we had to give. There was no gun or anything, but we had to give the batteries to the person, and then we continued on our way. The batteries were helpful for the armies. So I love this image because it's reminding us that we are wealthy, and when we doubt, we're opening what our wealth is to attack, to be stolen away. So doubt is when we, we could say, by thinking that we are not intrinsically valuable, by thinking that we have to earn our place on earth, we have to earn our belonging, that we're not good enough, or that the practice is not going to be good enough, that this way that I'm fumbling along isn't enough. That's doubt. So that's where we have the wealth, we have our way of feeling our way, we have this true heart. And doubt is like exposing that to robbers. And being free of doubt is like, ah, we got across the desert. And everyone is okay. Everything is here. We have still the food and the water and the... Just imagine now, probably in a desert caravan, they probably have a widescreen TV inside the the camel-drawn cart. But what we share, so that one reason I like that last image, reminding us of our wealth and how doubt is what could steal it from us. Could steal moments of connection with our wealth. Is that sometimes when we think of seeing clearly, what we think of is seeing the negative. And when we think of, we share our suffering. And when we're honest together, then we share our difficulties. But what I've noticed is what's even harder to share, to talk about among ourselves, it's sometimes hard to find a place that we could talk about the difficulties, but sometimes it's even harder to find a place we can talk about the true heart, about the sexual pleasure in meditation that comes sometimes. For periods of time, for many people. But does anyone talk about it? Very difficult. I keep talking about it, but I don't hear anyone else talking about it. And people come and, like, I don't. In the Buddhist tradition, and as in probably every spiritual tradition, there are a lot of times mentioned contact and conversations with. We could say, I was just reading today one of the Buddhist teachings about beings of light. And just as not any surprise that there would be beings of light, and using the beings of light that one had contact with as a metaphor for something else. So it was just so commonplace to talk about the beings of light that we said, oh, it's just like when all those beings of light come together in a room, you know, right? And... And there's that radiance there. And you can tell that there's different colors, but you can't tell that anyone is maybe brighter than the other. So it's used as a metaphor. And then at the end of the story, the person who's listening asks the teacher, who in this case is not the Buddha, but one of the Buddha students. So not even only the great Buddha is meeting light beings, but one of his students. So the listener says to the teacher, it sounds almost as if you've actually had conversations with these light beings, these beings of light. And the teacher says, even though your question is rude, I will answer it. Yes, I have had and I have many conversations many times with these beings of light. And so another thing that's been left behind often as we bring the, let's say, Buddhist tradition from the West to the East is this kind of thing that in our contemporary culture we don't really talk about in the contemporary culture of spiritual seekers. If we're not in a kind of new age tradition where that's all we want to talk about, then we don't talk about it. And again, it's not like that you should have, but that you could have. Or we could actually say, what do we mean by light being? It could be like an experience of lightness. It could be an experience of so much brightness or so much lightness that it was noticeable. It was like almost like being in touch with an energy. So we may need to find our own experience and then hearing the echo of that in the tradition, being able to find our own language the way they had their own language. But not to ignore that half of our experience just because no one else is talking about it. I think in the last few years, people have gotten more comfortable talking about experiences of vastness. But even maybe 10, 15 years ago on retreats, that was another word that was not used. So we can just keep... breaking through our own restrictions on what we think we're allowed to experience and see and talk about. Not only the negative, not only the positive, and not just inventing some kind of average between the negative and the positive and calling that the middle way. But some kind of honesty from the true heart that is not limited to being honest with words, but also a kind of honesty of presence. That finds the kind of yumminess, the what could be better, in the practical and in the subtle, in the high and the low, also in the conceptual, then we don't need to become a new tradition that's anti-conceptual, anti-intellectual, but we can find what's yummy, what could be better, then clarifying that idea. And then what could be better than stopping to talk about that idea and giving room for this experience that's beyond words. So a kind of contact with that true heart that we could call honesty beyond words. We could call, yesterday it came as the words, dharmic presence. A presence that is infused with Dharma. That's not mine. It's not yours. But it can come about in the meeting. It can come about in the meeting between two people. It can come about in the meeting inside with vastness. What could be better? That much freedom. Thank you for listening. Please enjoy the sunshine. Mm-hmm. Walking in the hall. Standing. Inventing your way.